content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On our last program, we began reading the exclusive book excerpt called Trailblazer by Marilee Grindle. Anthropologist Celia Natal traveled the globe, decoded the Aztec calendar, and transformed the way we think of ancient Mesoamerica. At this point in the article, Mrs. Natal is divorced from her husband and is working to learn the native Aztec language, Nahuatl, and we'll pick up where we left off. In 1892, Zelia presented a paper in Spain about the Aztec calendar stone. Buried during the destruction of the Aztec Empire, the calendar stone had been unearthed in December 1790, when repairs were being made to the Zocalo, Mexico City's central plaza. The sculpted stone, some 12 feet in diameter and weighing 25 tons, became a popular attraction exhibited in the Mexico City Cathedral, steps from where it had been found. Antonio de Leon y Gama, a Mexican astronomer, mathematician, and archaeologist, had written about its discovery and praised the intelligence of the Aztecs who had created it. Alexander von Humboldt, who saw the stone when he visited Mexico in 1803 to 1804, included a drawing in his views of the Cordilleras and monuments of the indigenous peoples of the Americas, published in 1810, and encouraged Mexican intellectuals to study the meaning of its concentric circles and numerous glyphs. Many others took on its puzzles in the years that followed. At the time of Zelia's presentation, the Mexican upper classes were carefully crafting a new national image, a story that would allow Mexico to take its place among the modern nations of the world. The Aztecs, Maya, Olmecs, Toltecs, Zapotecs, and other cultures had left their imprints throughout the country in magnificent temples, enigmatic statues, gold jewelry, jade figurines, and painted murals. The history was reclaimed as a national heritage every bit as glorious as those of Greece and Rome. A statue of Cuauhtomac, the Aztec king who resisted Cortez, took its place on Mexico City's elegant Paseo de la Reforma in 1887. The calendar stone had been installed in a place of honor in the National Museum in 1885. But little was known about the actual customs and beliefs of those ancient people. With her extraordinary knowledge of surviving codices, Celia offered a novel reading of the giant calendar stone that had stumped others and provided new insights into the annual and seasonal cycles of daily life in ancient Mexico, illuminating the cosmology, agriculture, and trade patterns of the Aztecs. She presented another version of the paper at the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago in 1893. Celia returned to Mexico City in February 1902, and after a personal audience with Mexican President José de la Cruz Porfirio Díaz, arranged by the U.S. ambassador, she embarked on a spree of travel to archaeological sites she had long wanted to visit. In May, she and 20-year-old Nadine, her daughter, joined friends at the Ahuacan ruins at Mitla, a religious center where the place of the dead harbored both Mixtec and Zapotec art and architecture. On this dry, high plain ringed by mountains, Celia strolled across vast stone patios, inspected the elaborate geometric friezes that lined and decorated them, explored temples, and imagined a sophisticated society of kings, priests, nobles, artisans, and farmers. Celia was welcomed into the international community of anthropologists in Mexico. She and Nadine traveled in the Yucatan with their young American anthropologist Alfred Tauzer, where they were beset by frequent rain and terrible roads. Arriving tired and wet in a small town, Tozer, who would one day chair Harvard's Department of Anthropology, was impressed by the women's resilience. Imagine the picture, he wrote to his family on April 8, 1902. Mrs. Nuttall, never accustomed to roughing it, a woman entertained by the crowned heads of Europe, sitting at a bench with the top part of my pajamas on drinking chocolate, and her daughter with a flannel shirt of mine on doing the same. After a few months, Celia and her daughter returned to Mexico City and purchased a mansion they called Casa Alvarado in the upscale suburb of Coyoacan. The grand house never failed to impress. Frederick Starr, an anthropologist from the University of Chicago, was one of many who found the palace beautiful and restful. We rode out to Coyoacan, where we found Mrs. Nuttall and her daughter really charmingly situated. The color decoration is simple and strong. Nasturtiums are handsomely used in the patio and balcony effects. Why Mrs. Nuttall dressed, Miss Nuttall, showed us through the garden where a real transformation had been effected. Living in Mexico energized Celia. In addition to her affiliation with Harvard, she had funding to travel and collect artifacts for the Department of Anthropology at the University of California. With me here, in touch with the government and people, I think that American institutions can but profit, and that I can do some good in advancing science in this country, she confided to Putnam, who was the curator of Harvard's Peabody Museum of Archaeology and Ethnology, and a leading expert at the time on Mesoamerica. Impressed by her knowledge of the country's past, public officials and foreign visitors came to see her and listened carefully as she led them around her home and garden, explaining the collection she was busy assembling. Her garden, patio, and verandas were home to an increasingly large number of stone artifacts. A beautiful carving of the serpent god Quetzalcoatl, revered for his wisdom among them. She took up digging near Casa Alvarado, an activity one guest later recalled fondly. Every morning after breakfast, Mrs. Nuttall would give me a trowel and a bucket. She herself was equipped with a sort of short-handled spade, and we would go out into the surrounding country and dig. We mostly found broken pieces of pottery, but she seemed to think some of them were significant, if not valuable. She was a very handsome woman and very charming. She lived in great style with many Mexican servants. Celia continued to travel throughout the country. She found a 14-page codex painted on deerskin with commentary in Nahuatl that she believed so valuable that she bought it with her own money, selling some of her possessions to afford it. Owing to my residence here, I must keep it a profound secret that I possess and sent out of the country this codex, she wrote to Putnam. While she was not above smuggling treasures out of Mexico, Celia also worked in the National Museum, contributing to its displays and archives, and she became an honorary professor of the institution. Her Sunday teas at Casa Alvarado were a study in salon orchestration. She would have 30 or 40 people, and she would change the group she invited, one visitor recalled. Sometimes they were all people who knew each other, or else she would bring people together she wanted to introduce to each other. They weren't like old-style Mexican parties, with all the women on one side and men on the other. The men and women were mixed together. According to an oft-repeated legend, at one of her soirees, she advanced to welcome an eminent guest just as her voluminous Victorian drawers came loose and dropped to her ankles. She calmly stepped out of them and proceeded as if nothing had happened. Celia was above all self-confident. Celia Nuttall left Mexico during the early months of 1910 and did not return to her beloved Casa Alvarado for 7 years. Throughout that time, Mexico was in the midst of a violent revolution. As many as 2 million people lost their lives in the 10-year conflict, and the country's infrastructure was reduced to tatters. Even after the end of the most extensive violence, turmoil erupted sporadically until the late 1920s. By then, visitors to Casa Alvarado agreed that Celia was rooted in a bygone era. She was a middle-aged woman with thick glasses who favored shawls, laces, and jet beads. Her palace was still filled with stuff only a Victorian could accumulate, but Mexico was telling new stories about itself. The elites of the previous generation had asserted that the descendants of the Aztec, Maya, and other civilizations deteriorated into poverty and abandon. Young artists and intellectuals now rejected this belief. In Diego Rivera's vast public murals, he showed the people of Mexico being ground into poverty and submission by Spanish conquistadors, a rapacious church, foreign capitalism, the army, and cruel politicians. Quetzalcoatl replaced Santa Claus at the National Stadium. Chapultepec Park hosted Mexico Night. Celia did not like the revolution, and she did not approve of what came after it. She did not celebrate the masses. She believed in hierarchy and a natural order of classes and races. Yet she was determined to be relevant to a new era in Mexico. Casa Alvarado became a meeting place for politicians, journalists, writers, and social scientists from Mexico and abroad, many of whom came to witness the possibilities of change in the aftermath of a people's revolution. Nevertheless, the stubborn elegance of Casa Alvarado in the 1920s was clear testimony that Celia was not willing to give up her lifestyle. When the French-American painter Jean Charlot was a guest at one of Celia's teas, he was aghast at the Mexican servants in white gloves. When Celia Nadal died in 1933, the U.S. consul in Mexico City wrote to Nadine, by then a 51-year-old widow living in Cambridge, assuring her that they'd given her mother a tasteful funeral. "Your mother was very highly thought of here, as evidenced by the floral offerings and the number of her friends who came to the funeral service at the cemetery, it being estimated that about 100 persons were present." By that time, the field of anthropology was dramatically changing, becoming more systematic and organized. Those who entered the field in the 1920s and 1930s built expertise in the classroom and under supervision in the field, passing a variety of tests and milestones determined by academic experts and acquiring a credential as proof of the right to pursue these inquiries. With these rigorous new standards, they asserted their superiority as scholars over those of Celia's generation. Yet Alfred Tauzer, in his memorial in the journal American Anthropologist, reflected that Celia was a remarkable example of 19th century versatility. She was wrong in some of her overarching theories. For instance, she fallaciously argued that ancient Phoenician travelers had carried their culture to Mesoamerica. But she was right about many other things. Through her letters, articles, and books, we can trace what she got right and what she got wrong as a scholar, and we can follow her as she moved from one research obsession to the next. Her private life is harder to grasp. Among all the artifacts, there is little about the quips and gossip she exchanged with friends, the piano music she liked to play and sing. We cannot know of what was in the boxes of papers in the cellar of Casa Alvarado that were burned in the house cleaning undertaken by its new tenants. We cannot retrieve personal and public documents lost in the San Francisco earthquake in 1906. What we do know is that she had to make sacrifices, often very personal ones. We can feel her vulnerability, uncertainty, anger, and embarrassment in the letters she wrote, as well as her self-assuredness. It required unusual self-discipline to learn so many languages and to gain a mastery of ancient pictographs. Her almost constant travels imperiled her health even while they advanced her vast network of friends, colleagues, and patrons. But she continued to work, and that work helped build the foundation on which many others now build. A single mother pursuing a career while looking after a family in a man's world, in some ways, Celia Nadal was a very modern woman. Next, we'll move on to an article titled It Can't Happen Here by Autumn Hochschild. An ambitious New Deal program brought fascism into the spotlight. Then the drama moved onto the political stage. When Dorothy Thompson disembarked from the ocean liner Leviathan in New York on September 14, 1934, it was the first time the reporters waiting at the dock seemed more interested in her than in her Nobel Prize-winning husband, the novelist Sinclair Lewis. He, too, had come to meet her and was waiting at the side of the pier, quietly irritated by all of the attention she was getting. Thompson, a writer for the Saturday Evening Post and other publications, was in the spotlight as the first American correspondent to be expelled from Nazi Germany. A few weeks earlier, she was having breakfast in her Berlin hotel room. A trench-coated Gestapo agent had appeared at the door with an order that she leave the country within 24 hours. Under police escort, she boarded a train for Paris the next day, her arms filled with American beauty roses given to her by the cluster of fellow foreign correspondents who came to see her off. Although Adolf Hitler usually avoided one-on-one interviews, Thompson, who spoke German fluently, had managed to obtain one several years earlier, before he took office. She found a man whose countenance is a caricature, a man whose framework seems cartilaginous, without bones. He is inconsequent and voluble, ill-poised, insecure, the very prototype of the little man. His eyes had the peculiar shine which often distinguishes geniuses, alcoholics, and hysterics. This description how infuriated the future dictator, and he demanded from himself, his staff, immediate translations of anything else she published. Later, she watched stormtroopers marching down Unter der Linden, shouting curses at Jews. I saw them in my mind's eye, marching on and on, over frontiers north, east, west, and south, she wrote. The boiling kettle had exploded. Back in the United States, Thompson embarked on the first of several marathon lecture tours warning against the rise of fascism. She found the country in turmoil. Desperate voters had placed their hopes on Franklin D. Roosevelt, but so far his New Deal had done little to ease the pain of the Great Depression. Every day brought shocking headlines. 10 men paroled from a Pennsylvania prison asked to be readmitted because they couldn't find jobs. Chicago ran short of money to pay school teachers. In Appalachia, some people were surviving on wild grass, roots, and dandelions. Millions of out-of-work Americans were evicted from their homes and plunged in just the kind of despair that had made it so easy for a charismatic leader like Hitler to point to scapegoats. And America had its own rising demagogues. One was Father Charles Coughlin, the golden-voiced radio priest. Weekly broadcasts brought to a vast audience a sonorous baritone that would rise to a passionate crescendo. According to one poll, some 16 million people heard him at least once a month. Ministers rescheduled church services so they would not lose parishioners to Coughlin's tasks, and high school football games were timed to end before he went on air. He spoke to live audiences as large as 30,000 people and received more mail than the president. He had long denounced bankers and financiers, at least once calling them Shylocks. By the late 1930s, would make strident diatribes against Jews. A newspaper he controlled printed installments of the notoriously false Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and the decade's end would find Coughlin praising Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. The evils of communism, he claimed, stemmed from a Russian revolution that had been backed by Jewish bankers. Coughlin was building a national movement. Meanwhile, some Ku Klux Klansmen in Georgia, imitating followers of Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, began calling themselves the Black Shirts. Admirers of Hitler would soon form themselves into the German-American Bund, whose brown-shirted followers drilled beneath the Nazi flag at a network of summer camps. Occultist William Dudley Pelley started a paramilitary militia known as the Silver Shirts. Pelley told a congressional committee that Mr. Hitler had done an excellent job in Germany and that America could address the Jewish question by gathering all Jews into one city in each state. Sinclair Lewis absorbed his wife's alarm at the rise of the Nazis. His marriage to her was clouded by his alcoholism, his violent rages, and his jealousy of her expertise about European politics and headline-winning expulsion from Germany, from Nazi Germany. "If I ever divorce Dorothy," he would say, "I'll name Adolf Hitler as a co-respondent." Even so, the year after Thompson's return from Germany, Lewis plunged into a 9 hours a day, 7 days a week marathon of writing to produce a novel about fascist takeover in America. It Can't Happen Here portrays an unscrupulous, power-hungry senator named Berzelius Buzz Windrip, who, aided by a Coughlin-like Bishop Prang, wins the 1936 presidential election. When he'd had a few drinks, Lewis enjoyed doing imitations of Coughlin and other demagogues of his day. Windrip proclaims martial law, and an armed militia, the Minutemen, or MM, and a nod to Hitler's SS, helps him override courts and Congress and throw his enemies in prison. The plot goes on, and probably from there. Although far from great literature, I've done better books, the author acknowledged. The novel touched a nerve, and it sold 320,000 copies. The novel is in print today, amid growing concerns about authoritarianism both in the United States and abroad. At one point in 2017, it appeared on Amazon's list of top 10 best-selling books. But few people remember the play that the book inspired. It Can't Happen Here was one of the most popular nationwide theater events of the Great Depression, staged by a remarkable, largely forgotten branch of Roosevelt's New Deal. The play reached hundreds of thousands of audience members in multiple languages and also helped provoke a real-life drama, a congressional investigation whose star was an undercover agent. The Federal Theater Project was led by Hallie Flanagan, who was, in the words of actor and director John Houseman, a small red-haired lady with the firm mouth and ferocity of an aroused lion. In 1935, she was directing the acclaimed experimental theater program at Vassar College when she received a call from her old friend, Harry Hopkins. He was now the head of the Works Progress Administration, the agency creating jobs for millions of Americans as the centerpiece of the New Deal. He invited her to Washington, where he told her, "Unemployed actors get just as hungry as anybody else." Hopkins already had plans to create jobs for out-of-work writers and artists, but there was a bolder dimension to the administration's hopes for reviving the theater. At the White House, Flanagan later recalled, Eleanor Roosevelt asked her whether the time had come when America might consider the theater, as it was considered abroad, a part of education. The First Lady figured most Americans would say no if the matter were put to a vote. But since Congress had already set aside money to take care of people in need, a federal theater project seemed worth a try. With that, Flanagan became the head of a major New Deal program. She and Hopkins fleshed out plans for this unprecedented venture as they traveled by train to a theater conference in Iowa, where Flanagan's appointment was to be announced. Everything she saw out the windows as they steamed through the cities of the Midwest reinforced the urgency of putting people back to work. These slums through which we were riding, these ramshackle, vermin-infested buildings housing our fellow citizens were one reason, she recalled in her 1940 memoir. These pale children sitting listlessly on fire escapes were another. Sullen youths hanging around our street corners were another. Worried-looking men gathered in silent knots before employment agencies were still another. In a country where many people could no longer afford an evening at the theater, Thousands of men and women on relief were jobless actors, directors, set designers, musicians, and stagehands. At its peak, the Federal Theater Project employed nearly 13,000. It put the lights back on in dozens of theaters, and its productions also traveled to prisons, reformatories, settlement houses, and psychiatric hospitals. In the summer, the project mounted free plays in parks. When 1 million people in the Ohio River Valley fled a disastrous flood, a Federal Theater Project vaudeville troupe performed for weeks in the camps, shuttered factories, and garages where refugees were housed. One murder mystery, in which members of the audience were enlisted as witnesses and jurors, was mounted across the country in 258 civilian conservation corps camps, where young men were at work planting more than 3.5 billion trees and constructing bridges, trails, shelters, roads, and buildings in state and national parks. Altogether, the project's more than 1,200 plays would be seen by nearly 30 million people, up to 65% of whom had never seen live theater before. It Can't Happen Here, Flanagan and her staff thought, would make a splendid, timely play. Sinclair Lewis was not known for being a playwright, however, so Flanagan paired him with the Hollywood scriptwriter John C. Moffat. Their collaboration turned out to be tempestuous, and the two were soon not on speaking terms. Flanagan installed them in apartments on different floors of New York's Essex House on Central Park South, where they wrote and raged at each other while she mediated by passing notes between them. Mr. Moffat paced up and down in his apartment and threatened, if Mr. Lewis did not omit certain scenes and include others, various unusual reprisals. She later recalled in her memoir, before long, Moffat fled back to Hollywood, and Flanagan replaced him with another writer. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. We will finish that article on our next program. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.